Good morning to the listening audience. My name is Gloria Larive. I'm coordinator of the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five. Today's press conference will go right away to Mr. Garbus and Mr. Norris. It is about the affidavit which will be filed today. And I'd like first to say that it was on September 8, 2006, when the Miami Herald published an article by Oscar Corral, which stated that at least 10 journalists were on the U.S. payroll working for Radio and TV Martí. This was unknown before. And since then, that provided the basis for the appeals of the Cuban Five, centered mainly on that issue about the fact that many of the journalists in Miami were being paid by the government, unknown to the defense. We have uncovered millions of dollars worth of payments by these journalists, and there's much more to be discovered. And I would like to turn over the conference now to Mr. Martin Garbus, who has joined the legal team of the Cuban Five in April of this year. Mr. Garbus?
I'm here with Nelson, who's been with the case ever since the beginning. So he brings a very long perspective on a very, very long struggle. The documents that we will be submitting go into great detail about the way the American government, through Radio Martí, attempted to wrongfully influence the trial. Following up on what the Miami Herald investigation and New York Times investigations uncovered, we uncovered, through a variety of Freedom of Information Acts and our own investigation, information to show that over the 194-day period of the trial and over the nearly 2,000 days of a five-year period from 1996 to 2001, the jurors and the community in which they live were bombarded with documents that were paid for, where the authors were paid by the American government some monies, that these documents, some appearing in Miami Herald, on the Labor Herald, other places, but also on radio and on TV in Miami, that the talks, the speeches, the images, the words, had American government money involved in it. And it was part of a plan to influence the community and influence the jury to return a judgment of conviction against the defendants. The extent of it is being put together for the first time in this document. As I said, it's a result of exhaustive research. The government claims, amongst other things, that these issues should have been raised before, but it's absolutely clear that they couldn't have been raised before because nobody knew about them. At least the court did not know about them. Defense counsel did not and could not know about it. And the result was that even though the judge tried to insulate the jury from outside influences, neither she nor anyone else other than the government had any idea of the massive amount of energy, money, and time that was being used to influence this jury. In the United States, the government is not allowed to pay money for what we call domestic propaganda. If the government wants to take a political position, it's absolutely entitled to do it. But what they can't do is hire somebody, not tell the American listening audience who that person is being paid by, and not telling the American listening audience that the person who is articulating a position is articulating a government position. That violates the law, and there's a whole series of cases that deal with that particular violation. Now, the next question becomes, the government says, well, you can't prove that the jury is influenced by all of this media. And the answer is that it is the government, which has been guilty of wrongdoing, that has the obligation to prove that the jury has not been influenced, which is an impossible task. It seems to me that this is a case now that we have all the information together, should be resolved quickly, Gerardo Hernandez, at this point, has spent 13 years and 11 months in prison. September will be 14 months. The other defendants have also spent extraordinary amounts of time in prison, sometimes in solitary, sometimes not in solitary. And we believe that, given all the information that we will be presenting to the court, that the convictions should be reversed. I have practiced law for a good many years. I've never seen a case where you've had so much government influence attempted to get a jury to reach a verdict at the same time that the government is prosecuting a case. Other government agencies, in this case particularly Radio Marti, and what we do is working to help the government get that conviction. What the document does, to the extent that we know about it, it gets into the monies involved. We have vouchers. We have budgets from Radio Marti. We understand about Radio Marti moving basically into Miami in 1996, which is when the shootdown occurs, and the hiring of different staff personnel, those staff personnel having a commitment to a conviction. And what the document does is it goes into the backgrounds of some of the people that were hired by Radio Marti. The document talks about the government's action, because Radio Marti is the government. The ongoing, basically, in the hiring of people and allowing them to write propaganda, lies at the hands of the government. And the whole idea that a trial was going on at the same time is unprecedented. There's never been a case in American history where the American government is actually putting monies into a environment in order to influence a jury.
Our first question. I'm sorry, we do have a question. Okay. From Peter Roman from City University. Please go ahead.
Hi. How is this different from the motion for oral arguments that you presented in June? And have you received any answer on that motion for oral arguments? And the second question is, you mentioned Radio Marti, but then previously you mentioned also Miami Herald. Are you concentrating on Radio Marti, or did these same journalists write for Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald?
Well, with respect to your first question, this document, yes, we filed a motion previously, then the government responded, and this is in response to that, and this will be presumably the last document to be filed on the habeas corpus application, at least as of this moment, for the last documents that we will file. And with respect to who we're focusing on, we're focusing on government monies, wherever they went. So government monies went to the Miami Herald, went to the Nuevo Herald, it went to Radio Marti, so that you're talking about, and it also presumably went to other networks, other reporters. The Miami Herald investigation, so far as I understand it, they did a good deal of research. The entire investigation by Oscar Corral and the investigative team of journalists that work with him was not printed. It was edited down. And we don't know all yet. We don't yet know all the details of his investigation. So he may also have identified other people. The difficulty
is that?
Who
are you referring to?
The journalist who wrote the Miami Herald article.
Okay, good. Thank you. What's his name?
Oscar.
Uh-huh.
Corral. So he conducted an investigation, and he had a team of investigative journalists. And
Corral?
C as in cat.
Okay.
Corral.
Thank you.
Okay. So that I think responds to that series of questions.
Okay. And our next question comes from Walter Lippmann from Cuban News. Please go ahead.
Hi. I read the entire document, and it's a terrific amount of research. I noticed, I followed these matters closely, and I wanted to know what has happened to Oscar Corral, because after he wrote that article, he vanished from the Miami Herald, if you know what's become of him.
I don't know what's become of him. We tried to find him, and we were not successful. So I really don't know. I know that there was an article in the Sun Centennial a year later looking at his life. It was an interview with him. And in the interview, what he discusses what happened to him after the Miami Herald article. And he talks about fearing for his family's safety. He talks about having to move out and go to a separate place from his home to do the investigation. And then he talks about the accusations that were made against him. And he describes an awful, awful experience. That's about, as I said.
I remember that. Thank you. I remember that.
Yeah. And I have not seen anything since then.
Yeah, he seems to have been removed from journalism as a result of what he wrote there.
Well, I don't know if he's removed or voluntarily left, because I think he felt that, he may have felt, as I look at it, that he was not as supported as he might have been.
I'm Waldo from Prensa Latina. Mr. Garbus, thank you for this opportunity. I want to know, please, the purpose of this affidavit, and what do you expect from it concerning that, considering that government rejected or dismissed previous steps?
Well, I think that what this document, these documents that we file have, is a great deal more information and a great deal more specificity about who the paid journalists were, what they wrote, and why what they wrote was improper. It goes into both the facts far deeper, because we had more time to develop it, and it goes into the law much more deeply, again, because we had time to develop it. So that I think it takes the entire argument, I wouldn't say just a different step away, it just makes it totally different. In other words, the claim is when you, it's the volume of the material, it's the volume of the monies, the volume of the material, and the volume of the people involved. There has not been a document, any documents filed thus far in one place that tries to pull as much of this together as we can. I'm sure that if we had more time, we would be able to pull in more names. There comes a time when an investigation has to stop and you have to go before the court. The court could do a number of things. The court could order a hearing based on the information that we're seeking. Or what the court could do is decide on the basis of the paper that it has before it, either that the conviction should be vacated or that the motion to vacate the conviction should be denied. Those are basically the three options. And it's my belief, and I think the belief of some others, that there's enough information here, if not to require a vacature or a reversal of the conviction, then certainly at least a further investigation. What we say very candidly, what we will say very candidly in all these documents, is that we recognize that we don't have all the information, that over the years, since 2006, since the stories first came out, in the Miami Herald, the New York Times, recognize that there's a great deal more information. And there are various places that the government has blocked, not only us, but has blocked scholars, congressmen, from finding out where all these Marti funds went to. Now, the Government Accountability Office each year, not each year, but many years, issues a report about Radio Marti. And the reports are fairly extensive. If you go through those reports, you will not find one mention of any funds that are going to private journalists who work for places like the Miami Herald or CBS TV. So it's a extraordinary job to get this information that is deliberately buried so that it avoids not just this case, but congressional and scholarly inquiry. Bill, are you back?
Thank you very much.
Yes, I'm back.
Oh, okay. Bill Norris is back, and maybe he can say something.
Yeah, well, I successfully cut myself off when Mr. Garbus finished his opening remarks and threw it over to me is when I cut myself off. And I did want to add to what Mr. Garbus said, the point which I view as significant, and that is that the defense team had absolutely no knowledge that this was happening at all, and certainly no knowledge of the extensive, pervasive intrusion of the journalists being paid by Radio Marti in the Miami media environment. And as a consequence of not having that knowledge, we were not able to do anything that would have protected our clients from this, if there is anything that could have been done, and we're never able to raise the issue to the surface where the court could consider it. And of course, while the individual prosecutors may or may not have had any knowledge of this, certainly the government as an entity did, because it was the government who was paying these journalists. That information was never brought to the court's attention. The court did everything that it could under the circumstances to insulate the jury that we had from this kind of outside influence. But of course, the court couldn't do anything to protect against an influence that it had no knowledge of. And that, I think, is the one of the critical significances of what Mr. Garbus has prepared and what he'll be filing, is to bring all of that to the court's attention.
Oh, yes, this is Ed Newman at Radio Havana, Cuba. Can you hear me?
Yes. You could speak a little louder. That would be helpful.
Sure. We know that the judge in Miami, Judge Joan Leonard, be seeing this appeal. What would happen if, is there another process if she refuses to consider this 82-page document and go for more discovery? Do you go to the appeals process, to a court of appeals, or ultimately to the U.S. Supreme Court? What happens if it's not heard in Miami?
Bill, do you want to?
Yes, well, the question is a straightforward question, but it goes into it's a broader process. This matter is before the court on what's called collateral review, or a petition for writ of habeas corpus. And the papers that Mr. Garbus is filing are part of the submission to the court. So the court has to, as an initial matter, decide what to consider in making her decision. The question of what she chooses to consider or not consider is not initially appealable. That when she makes her decision, then the matter can be appealed to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta. If she refuses to consider the matters that Mr. Garbus has brought forward, or refuses to allow additional discovery. But the threshold question is, what does she consider, and that's the stage that we're at now.
And we do have a question from Tracy Eaton from Freelance Journalist. Please go ahead.
Hi. I'm wondering if you have any evidence that there was collusion between such agencies as Radio Marti and the prosecution team. In other words, can you connect more closely the prosecution with the media agencies responsible for the domestic propaganda, as you described it? Thank you.
I think there's no direct proof that we know of at the moment between the people who worked as journalists and the prosecution team. That would be the subject of discovery. And we have asked in our document for an opportunity to see if there was the kind of contact that existed between the government, the Radio Marti, and the prosecution team, if any. There were a new set of directives issued by Attorney General Eric Holder Jr. in April 2010, where he talks about the responsibility of government prosecutors to disclose information. Those guidelines were issued after the government was castigated for some of its failed prosecutions, Senator Stevens in Alaska and others. and it talks to the need for the government to be forthcoming. Forthcoming when it talks about interagency relationships, let's assume between Radio Marti and the prosecutor. And it also requires the government to talk about interrelationships between it and state and local agencies, given the fact that state and local agencies and the federal government have collaborated in the past on prosecutions and on events. The question is, what kind of cooperation, if any, was here? It may be that Marti people spoke to state and local agencies who then transmitted information in one form or another to the government. It may be that the government, federal government, the prosecutor got information that it did not even know came from Radio Marti and the other paid journalists. So the question was just asked is a good question. It's a question that we don't have all the answers to. It's a question that we say we're entitled to have answers to. Thank you.
And we have another question from Gloria Milano from Liberation News. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My question is for Mr. Norris. You are representing Ramon Labanino. How will his case and that of the rest of the Cuban tribe be affected by the appeals document of Gerard Hernandez? Thank you.
Well, that is correct. I represent Ramon Labanino. He is serving a sentence of 30 years. As Mr. Garbus mentioned in his opening remarks, that he has now served 14 of that 30 years, which leaves 16 years left on his sentence. And he has raised this issue in his initial papers, and the issue is tremendously significant to the environment in which he was convicted. But the general attitude that was sponsored by the government operation of Radio Marti generally and the payment specifically to journalists who then repeated their comments both in the print media and the radio media and the television media. Created an atmosphere that was absolutely inconsistent with our concept of ordered justice and fair presentation of proof that leads to a conviction. In other words, the entire public opinion and atmosphere was polluted, and Mr. Labanino did not receive a fair trial. So he very much is interested, very much has reason to look forward to full airing of these issues. Thank you.
We have Walter Lippmann from Cuban News back online. Please go ahead.
My question is, what is the path in to have something, to have a basis to compare? What is the previous experience in raising questions of the storm of media prejudice on the outcome of cases in the legal system? It's an extraordinary situation. Thank you.
Well, I think that Bill Norris or I could go into a long disquisition about that, but I think the significant thing is there is no body of case law that deals with the government affecting the media this way in a case that is prosecuting. There are many, many cases that deal with publicity in cases and how publicity can jeopardize a grand jury. You have motions for change of venue. You have a whole variety of things. But this is totally different than any case in reported American legal history. And it's different not because Bill or I say it's different, but it's different because you have not had a case where you have seen so much government involvement in trying to influence a jury. It is, as we lawyers say, sui generis, it stands by itself. So you don't have to get into long and lengthy legal briefs about what has the Supreme Court done in this publicity case or in that change of venue case. This is totally different. This is not a change of venue situation. This is a situation basically dealing with the government's wrongful attempt to try and influence a jury. Now, the government has every right, as I've said before, to have a propaganda machine directed overseas, the Voice of America or whatever. There is no right for the government to take that propaganda machine, turn it on the citizens of Miami while a trial is going on. The propaganda machine was allegedly built for reasons of foreign policy, for national security. The integrity of the domestic American trial process cannot be destroyed by any kind of propaganda machine. And there are no cases that deal with it because it is so clear and uncontradicted and unarguable. Once you accept the facts of this case, what happens? It's basically the argument that we're making is fact-based. Once you accept the fact of the number of journalists, the amount of money, the amount of time that was spent bombarding the jury with a certain version of the facts of the case and a certain version of Cuban-American relationships and the history of the Cold War, once you look at all those different disparate elements weaved into documents that are coming out as the trial is going on, that are coming out just as the jury is getting the trial, then there has been nothing like that before. And the timing of the articles that came out, when they came out, let's say during the trial period, is remarkable. The day the jury gets the case, there's an article by someone who's a paying journalist who says that drugs were fed to Castro's agents, including the defendants in this case. Now, the sourcing for the article is fundamentally non-existent. It's based on pseudonyms. It refers to unnamed people, and it comes out the day the jury gets the case. So a question is, when was the article written? Why was it written? What is the basis for the article? And isn't it a clear attempt to influence the jury? Now, you can do that with hundreds and hundreds of articles. We have done it with some of them, and that's what we submitted to the court. That's the end of our response.
Can we take one more question? Well, I'd like to make a comment about this. My name is Gloria Lariva. And following with what Mr. Garbus said, the affidavit includes details of many of these articles and new discoveries since what was presented months ago in the recent affidavit and motions by the other attorneys and the other of the Cuban Five. And there's one example that's truly astounding. This is new, and that's why we hope for the wide distribution in the media, in public forums, and protests around the world, even beyond the courtroom, to expose the government's operation in Miami. And one, for example, which is in the affidavit details, is that of Luis Aguilar León, who was not known by us or the court or the defense to have been on the Radio Martí payroll for many years from the very beginning, 1985. Luis Aguilar León was the editor of the editorial page of El Nuevo Herald at the same time that he was receiving government money. And yet the payments to him are not evident in any of the documents that the government has given to us, which is really limited, or in the federal database, which is available, which shows who received payments from the government in general. And yet he was a long-time employee of Radio Martí. Now, what was his role in Miami? In Miami, as the editorial page editor of El Nuevo Herald, 1 month before the shootdown of Brothers to the Rescue in January, there is an article that appears, and this is in the documents you will see today, an article appears that announces that the government is forming a panel of four prominent journalists to examine the integrity of Radio Martí given the complaints about its bias. And this was January 1996.
That panel was composed of Dan Bradley, the famed editor of the Washington Post, the director of the School of Journalism in Columbia University, the ex-director of NBC News National, and the fourth person was Luis Aguilar León, and he is described in the media as the editorial page editor of El Nuevo Herald, but it doesn't say to the public that he also was working for Radio Martí at the time he's supposed to examine its integrity. Then 1 month later, 3 days after the shootdown of the Brothers to Rescue planes, which is the charge, the false charge that Gerardo Hernández is serving life for today, and that article, this editorial that appears in Miami, I'm paraphrasing, but the document is in the affidavit, in which this man says, I wish I had three armed jets to menace the people of Cuba. And he says, and I wish that I could shoot the people who are on Varadero Beach as they flee across the sands. And that is an open call for violence, for terrorism. And this is a man who was being portrayed as an independent journalist. He was on the payroll since 1985. This is why the defense, why Mr. Garbus and the attorneys are demanding discovery and full exposure of the government's operation in Miami. And for the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five and the hundreds of organizations around the world who've been working arduously for the freedom of the Five in the political and public realm, you know, in conjunction with the legal struggle, we see the affidavit and the whole issue of the paid journalist in Miami as critical in exposing to the world, to human rights organizations, and especially to the people of the United States, this absolute abuse and violation of the rights of five men who were fighting terrorism and trying to save the lives of people. So I don't know if there's any more questions. But
thank you. I think that you have finished it. Wonderful. Thank you very much.